Well, I'd like to put a question to all the men here this morning and just simply ask you, what kind of man are you? What kind of man? How would you describe yourself? How do you see yourself? Let me ask it this way, too. How would your wife describe you personally? Not how would your wife describe a man of God, right? But how would she describe you? Would she define you as a man of God? What about your children or your grandchildren? What would they have to say about you? Would they also use the same standard that you are using? Or would they look at something else that you are not paying attention to? Or would they use a completely different standard? What have they been taught to say? What have they been taught to look at? What do you think I would think about you? I mean, if we were to sit down in a very candid, open conversation, and you asked me directly, Chad, do you think I am a man of God? How would I respond to that for you personally? What would I address? What would I be looking at? Much more importantly than that, how would Christ evaluate you? Would he call you a man of God? Would that be the way he defined you? Would that be the way that he would summarize your character? Now, I'm not saying any of those conversations would go badly. What I'm saying is that that's really how we need to look at things. Not just simply how we feel about ourselves, but how are other people looking at us? More importantly, how does God look at us? If you are a Christian, this ought to be a question of great importance to you. Something you should strive for, something that you should focus on, something that you should strive to improve and exercise the quality of. And the reason why that is because Jesus himself placed extreme importance on the same thing. He could not have been our worthy example, our model example. He could not have been our Redeemer. He could not have been the Son of Man, could not have been the Son of God by failing to be a man of God. So I want you to just think about that. It was extremely important to Christ. Therefore, whatever is important to him needs to be important to me, needs to be important to you. Of course, that begs the question, what does a man of God look like? And modern stereotypes of men, especially Hollywood's version of that, miss the point entirely. We have, of course, the tough, muscular, good-looking man who lives on the edge, drives his car fast, or drives a fast bike, and he smokes, he swears, he drinks, he gambles, but he's admired by many, especially young men, for his ruggedness and for his testosterone-driven life. There's that aspect of a man, Hollywood's version. And there's the other type of man, educated, highly educated, intelligent. He's a corporate executive, perhaps, a high salary, lives in a luxurious home, wears name brand clothes, wears exquisite cologne, and so on. There's another aspect of the world's version of a man. Or there's the sportsman, of course, who fishes and hunts and knows everything about fishing and hunting and so on. And he wears flannel shirts and Carhartt pants and, of course, boots everywhere he goes. He's an expert with guns. He drives a 4x4. Now, guys, if you drove a 4x4 here this morning, I'm not saying that's you necessarily. I'm just simply saying there's a scenario here, right? A portrayal. A depiction that we're looking at, and a kind of a package, if you will. And then, of course, there's that sexy, suave, perhaps a ladies' man, or the guy has the prettiest wife, the most popular children, or most popular with children. He's everybody's pal, and everyone looks up to him in that way. There's that kind of man, too. Of course, usually he's just an actor, like you see on the screen here, right? I mean, just portrays something. So I want you to think about that. The problem with all of these portrayals is that these are men based on the world's standard, not on God's standard. Our secular culture may want or admire such men, but those kinds of men cannot hold a candle to the virtue, the excellency, and the piety and purity, the manliness itself of Jesus Christ. And left to themselves, if they do not uphold that righteousness of Christ, these people will not be with Jesus Christ. Just think about that. All these men of the world who pride themselves on being men of the world will not be with the Lord of heaven if they continue in simply a man of the world perspective. Many men are fond of saying in so many words, I'm my own man. But to really, if you look at that, that is false. You are following somebody. You are a follower of somebody. And many men have made them a prisoner of someone else's expectations. They cater to someone else's vision or version. They are a slave to the world. They are a slave to sin. Others say, well, I'm a man of God, and yet their heart remains elsewhere. And so we're not saying that God's not included in their life at all, usually as a subject or a concept, but that he's really not where their heart is. He is not the center of their life. So God's description surpasses all of that. What God looks for is a humble, contrite man who trembles at his word, which is really what Isaiah 66, the latter part of verse 2, says. God saying himself, this is the one I look for, who is humble, contrite of spirit, and trembles, or reveres highly my word here. That's the person who seeks his will, gives his full allegiance, gives full surrender of his heart to God. Joshua, for example, was not a man of God just because he was a warrior and carried around a sword. He was a man of God because he was willing to serve the Lord regardless of the decisions of other people. David was not a man of God just because he was a king. He was a man of God because he was a man after God's own heart, and he was willing to admit his sin and accept personal responsibility. Isaiah was not a man of God just because he was a prophet, but when time came to respond, just as we saw in the scripture reading there this morning, Isaiah 6, 1 through 8, when the time came to respond and God looked for someone to do his will, he says, here I am, send me. Nehemiah was not a man of God just because he was a cupbearer to the king, but because he made God's priorities his own, even to his own hurt, even to his own convenience. John the Baptist was not a man of God just because he was rugged and outdoorsy and ate locusts and wild honey and wore a leather belt, but because he denied himself and he fulfilled the role given to him by God. The fact is, men wear many hats. We do. We wear a lot of different hats, so to speak. We are husbands and fathers. We're breadwinners. We're civic leaders. We're role models. That's a heavy responsibility, and I'm not denying that. In fact, my prayer to God, my regular prayer to God, and this is literally how I ask God for help, Lord, please help me to be the man, the Christian, the husband, the father, the preacher that you need me to be, that I desperately need to be, because I realize that that is a daunting responsibility on all counts there, and that is not something that Chad is able to do on his own with his own skills and expertise, okay? I need to call upon a strength that is greater than my own in order to carry those roles out. So help me, Father, to do that. That's really what I'm doing is recognizing my own inadequacy and, yes, sometimes my failures in those different areas. There's no hat so important, so vital, so desperately needed as that of a man of God, especially in the Christian home, in the congregation, in one's personal sphere of influence. So we're going to look at a brief series here to see what God says about this subject. And we want to examine our own lives. I'm not here to examine your life for you. I'm not here to call attention to your situation personally. But I want you to examine your life and look for ways to improve. Look for ways to implement the good things that we learn here into our lives. I will admit this first lesson in identifying the problem is not necessarily a happy picture because we are identifying, after all, the problem, right? And so that's not necessarily something that we like. But the second lesson, we will be offering some workable solutions to those things. Let me start off by saying that the family is a basic unit of every society. There is no society that can exist successfully or for long without a family unit, a family base, a family structure. A family might be defined as a small social group of intelligent beings that needs to be desperately organized and led. I mentioned this recently in a class. We need to have organization in our family. In other words, we need structure, we need definition, we need organization. And secondly, we need to be led because we need direction. We need focus on a specific goal, on a specific objective. We can't just be floundering around or running around like chickens with their heads cut off, right, as the expression goes, and just aimlessly, you know, running in circles here. We have to have a direction. We have to be led in that direction. And since the beginning of time, men have been the leaders of their families. They are dominant in the family. They are dominant in society, in government, in religion. In other words, both biblical and secular history teaches us this. Through all of human history, this has been the case. And it's not just because the men are stronger or because they chose that role. God is the one who chose that role for men. And if God chooses that position or that role for men, then that means it's not an option for us. We can't just opt out and let women or children or other men, to determine that for us. Men are the head of marriage. Men are the head of the household. Men are the head of society. Men are the head of their congregations. That is what is being expressed here by Paul in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 3, where he says, I want you to understand, and he wants us to understand, that Christ is the head of every man, and that the man is the head of a woman, and that God is the head of Christ. And so there's an order, what we call a natural order here, and really referring to those of us who've been created, a natural order of creation. As God created the physical world and placed physical man in the physical world, he gave man structure and gave man leadership to govern his family, which is what the family needs. Unfortunately, just because a man is put in a leadership position there does not necessarily mean he automatically is going to be a leader. As all women can tell you, this role has often been abused. It has been misunderstood. Men have been unwilling. Men have been untrained. Men have been uneducated. Men have simply abdicated their roles altogether. That's one of the things we're seeing in the society today with regard to this whole gender nonsense, is just we have men and women, for that matter, abdicating their God-given roles and trying to choose something else. Okay, and you see the effect of that. It's really positive, isn't it? It's really helpful and contributing so much to the success of our society. Absolutely not. None of those things. So wives are not frustrated with capable men, loving husbands, and selfless fathers. They're not frustrated with that. They're frustrated with men who refuse to lead. That's what frustrates wives. Children are not exasperated with God-fearing dads who love Jesus and serve God. What frustrates them and what exasperates them is hypocritical fathers who play Christian when they're at church and are something else when they're at home. That is exasperating to children. Our society is not sinking into moral confusion and decay because of strong, wise, and capable Christian men, but because of the absence of those men or the suppression of those men's voices and influence. Okay, and some churches are not disorganized and lacking vision and embracing error because Christ-like men are upholding the word and righteousness and holiness to their own hurt, but because, sadly, churches are and men are becoming soft and lazy and undisciplined, afraid to lead, afraid to speak the name of Christ. So there's a problem here, and you can see the problem. And whether the problem is ours or not, I'll let you determine that. I'm simply identifying the problem, that we have a problem in the world. It is spilling into the brotherhood. We are being affected by that, just like we've been saying with social media. Here we have this man of the world image that is quickly becoming what people perceive as a man of God image, and it's completely erroneous. That is not a man of God. A leader is a strategic position. It is a duty, often confused with superiority or being above, being challenged and questioned. That's not what a leader is. Okay. If a great illustration is to draw on the military. The military commander is a superior officer. That's how he's referred to, as your superior. Okay. That doesn't mean he's a superior man, but he's in a superior position. And those who yield to him do so because they have respect for the office and the duty and the position, so that there will be law and order in that military. And the same thing works in a family as well as a congregation. There has to be positions of authority, positions of responsibility that are respected by those who are under those positions, not because those in those positions are superior men in every sense of the word. They're not morally flawless. They're not without defect. The fact is, though, that they have chosen a sacred responsibility, and they're doing their best, ideally, to live up to that. So we're honoring the position. We're honoring that rank, if you will. And in the absence of those positions, or the absence of that that command, if you will, or that law and order, not surprisingly, law and order breaks down. That's what you're seeing right now in America. You're seeing the breakdown. It's happening slowly, like watching a train wreck in slow motion. But we're seeing law and order actually breaking down. And where does that end up in? Well, it ends up in, if it's not checked, it's going to end up in anarchy. And that is something very ugly. Okay, so we want to put a check on that, or put a hold on that. And the best way we can do that as Christians is to be leaders of our own marriages and families first. And by leader, we want to refer to one who knows the right way in which to go. Secondly, one who leads by example. And thirdly, one who actively inspires others to follow him in that direction. Any man can follow the impulses of his testosterone, but does he know what is right? And is he leading by example? Is he worth following? Any man can marry a girl, but can he lead her to holiness and godliness? Is he himself conformed to Jesus Christ? Does he inspire her to do so? Any man can sire a child, but can he teach and direct his children so as to provide them with a moral and spiritual foundation? Does he live what he preaches? And do his children respect him, or are they taught to respect him? So, yeah, anyone can be a man in the most basic generic sense, right? But to be a man of God, that takes it to a whole different level. To be a man of God is a choice every man has to make and keep making every time that he considers his responsibility. So being an ideal leader really is a sacred responsibility. Not a flippant one, not a careless one, not a now and then one, not a self-centered one. It seeks the best interests of its followers, not of that person's own self-interests. Again, I want to stress, doesn't mean he's perfect. It doesn't mean he's flawless, but he is wise and discerning, confident in his judgment. He's credible. He's believable. We can say that he's followable. Okay, I know that's not a real word, but I just made it. He's someone that you can follow, that actually you want to follow. Remember what the qualities or attributes of a leader is. He inspires someone else to follow him actively, not just, well, if they can come if they want to, but I'm going. No, you actively go and encourage and inspire that person. Come with me. Follow me. That's part of being a leader. And it doesn't mean that because he's a leader that he's unconcerned about himself. It's not about selflessness in the absolute sense where you don't care about yourself. That's not what leadership is. Actually, paradoxically, leadership involves a very healthy respect for yourself, a healthy love for yourself, because you have to take care of your own soul in order to act in the best interest of other souls. You are not prepared, I will say it this way, you are not prepared to help someone else if you have not first taken care of your own responsibility to God. Noble as you might think that is, to go out there and try to save everyone else, the first person you need to save is yourself. And that's a very important thing to address here, okay? Not only yourself, but certainly yourself first. Not all men are leaders in every capacity. We understand that. I get that too, right? But in the family, leadership is a must. And the reason I say that is because this is a God-ordained system. God set this system up. He designed it. He handed this responsibility to men and said, I want you to run this, okay? And likewise, even within Christ's church, this is a must. This congregation, for example, the structure, the setup, the reason why we exist is a God-ordained system. So whatever systems God ordains and then puts people in charge of those systems, that is a pretty important responsibility. And that's really what we're looking for, not to evade responsibility like so many men do anymore, it seems, but rather to have men take a stand and live up to those responsibilities, take charge of that. I'll tell you that this is difficult, admittedly. This is really difficult, especially in a society that, as you know, champions the lowest common denominator, a society that applauds men who are sexually perverted, mentally unstable. In a society that criticizes men who love Christ, who have moral convictions, and who are uncompromising in their values. So what I'm saying is, men, this is important, it is necessary, but I admit to you from firsthand experience, this is very difficult to do. But it can be done. It is doable. Not only can we do it, but we must do it, because no one else is going to do it for us. The narrow way is not narrow because it's the easiest, because it's the most popular, because it's the one that's free from criticism. It is narrow because it forces us to conform to the highest standard, not to make us miserable, but rather to prepare us, to equip us, and yes, to save us. That's what this is all about. The narrow way is there to save us. So if you're going to take the narrow way, recognize that you just chose the most difficult way, but you also chose the very best way in which to live. With privilege comes responsibility. I've been hearing this all my life. And men have, I believe, some of the greatest privileges in society or in the family. And therefore, they are to be held to the highest responsibility and the highest accountability. The man of the world, unfortunately, he wants all these privileges, but he doesn't want all the responsibility. And we even have some Christian men, they're becoming sadly more and more common, that wants all the privileges, but doesn't want to accept the responsibility. Society supports and nurtures a man of the world, but the man of God is the one who preserves society and gives dignity and decency and direction to society. Man of the world isn't going to do any of that. Man of the world is concerned with one person, and that is himself and himself only, and whatever helps himself. You know, our society admires great athletes, and they are men to be admired, but actually goes further than that. Our society idolizes such people, holds them up as though they're some kind of god, and that we're all supposed to bow down to them, and puts huge emphasis on physical strength and physical endurance and physical ability, and yet very little concern for moral responsibility, spiritual values, and godly men. You're not going to see too many stories on ESPN about man's sexual irresponsibility or an athlete's profanity or his wasteful indulgences and the spiritual condition of their star athlete. You're not going to see much of that. They're going to focus on their dexterity and their capability and their strength and their, you know, great prowess on the football field or basketball court or something of that nature. They're going to avoid the other side of that altogether. Society makes role models of actors and celebrities and actually complete idiots, but rarely does it uphold someone who is holy and pure in heart, who hungers and thirsts for righteousness, and who confesses Christ. In fact, those people, when they do such things, are ridiculed and mocked and claimed to be bigoted and narrow-minded. You're not going to see too many people who are striving to honor God being lifted up by society as the paragon, the model example of that society. Realize, just think about this, and you can investigate this on your own if you want to waste your time, but I'll just tell you, if you were to look at all the actors and actresses, take the top, 20% of all the well-known actors and actresses and look at their religious background or their spiritual beliefs, you're going to find most of them, if they claim any religion at all, it's going to be very sparse. And then most of them are godless, pro-homosexual, anti-Christian atheists. So just think about what society is holding up. We have all these actors and celebrities that get on talk shows and sit there and start yakking, and people are like, oh, that's so important. That's so, illuminating. And it's not. It's just a bunch of drivel. You know, these people are actors. Don't forget what an actor is. It's someone who pretends to be something else, right? And so these people are held up as these model people, and yet most of them are promoting the godlessness, the anti-Christian sentiment in our world. Society praises men who claim to be tolerant of everyone's right to do something, whatever they want to do, or to believe whatever they want to believe, or become whatever they want to become. It's just amazing to me to be watching this. And yet they have a deep contempt for anyone who stands for absolute truth, and a deep contempt for anyone who stands for the Word of God, who upholds moral responsibility and who exercises not just love as society defines it, but true love, godly love. So here we are in the midst of this society that basically hates us, a society that chooses not to understand us, a society that wants to act completely different than us, and a society that will take every opportunity to shoot us down whenever it can and to ridicule us and misrepresent us and to demonize us in any way they can. That's the world we live in today. And you, men of God, if that's what you want to be, are going to have to stand up to that society. My question to you is not, should you do that? My question is, will you do that? And are you doing that? American men are among the most privileged men in the world. And sadly, they may also be among the most arrogant, irresponsible, and spoiled men on the earth. Their general departure from God's blueprint for husbands, fathers, and leaders has led to a materialistic group of men with very selfish agendas. In the past, men had to grow up very quickly. They had families to feed, they had crops to plant, they had crops to harvest, they had animals to raise, they had civic duties to attend to. Sometimes they had wars to fight. Yes, wars to preserve the integrity and morality of this country. And amidst all that, if that wasn't enough, they had church responsibilities to fulfill, and they did so. That's not what you're seeing today. Today's young men, statistically, are maturing later and later, into their late 20s, even into their early 30s. Many men of all ages lack moral convictions, the internal drive that compel other men to take on the responsibility and follow God. This is what we are facing as churches today. We are facing this problem. We're facing a group of men, generations of men, not just one generation, but generations of men who just want to sit back and let other people do the work. I've gone to a few funerals lately of preachers, and one thing that stands out, and the question was asked directly in those funerals is, okay, we've lost another leader. Who's going to take their place? Okay, we've lost another preacher. Who's going to stand up and preach in their place? You know what? I look around our brotherhood, and it's frightening what I see. I don't see a bunch of men eager to step up to the plate. I see a bunch of men standing back going, oh, I hope he doesn't call on me. I hope it's not me because I'm busy. I've got other things to do. I'm really not interested in getting into all that work. I'm not saying you have to be a preacher. That's not my point. My point is that we have responsibilities that need to be fulfilled, and who's filling them? It's not just, you know, the church business is not just old people's work. It is work that all men can do that are men. It's work for all of us. We need to step up to that if we're not doing so. In the past, men had to struggle just to put to survive and put food on the table. Today, many men are unmotivated. They are heavily distracted, largely with technology, as we've been addressing. They are unchallenged. They are untested, and often unchallenged and untested only because they refuse to be challenged and refuse to be tested. Someone says, adulting is hard. I keep seeing that on signs. Adulting is hard. That's why there's coffee. I like that one. But my point here is, you know, adulting, if we can make the word out of that, is hard. And therefore, it is often avoided. We have so many men who are unwilling to endure discomfort and inconvenience and sacrifice for the sake of what is needed to be done, the things that are necessary for men. And again, as the older generation of Christians leave, who's going to step up and take on those sacrifices and those commitments? Who in this congregation is going to step up? Remember our lesson we had not too long ago on the language of commitment. We don't need men to say, well, if that ever happens, if I'm ever called upon, I guess I could consider that. That's not commitment. We don't need men saying, I'm open to that, or I'm willing to do that. What we need is men to step up and say, I will do that. What can I do? That's what we need. I will admit the lure, the pull, the seduction of the world is strong. I will admit that the tide of popular opinion is strong against us. I will also admit that the desire to be lazy and uncommitted and disconnected but take all the perks is strong. I understand that. I feel that myself. I struggle with that myself. But here's the thing, and this has not changed. 1 John chapter 2, verse 16 and 17, John warns us that all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life, rather, is not from the Father, but is from the world, and the world is passing away. But the one who does the will of God abides forever, lives forever. So keep that in mind. While the lure, the pull, the seduction, the gravitation of the world is sucking all sorts of men toward it, remember that that world that so many people are gravitating toward, remember that that world is passing away, and everyone who is part of that world is passing away. I don't mean just dying physically. Sadly, we're talking about something far worse than that. So we want to keep that in mind. This has not changed. The effects of Christian influence are not felt only when they are present. They are also felt when they are missing, as we are experiencing in our society today. As God and His Word and Christians and Christian leadership and Christian men are being ridiculed and held in contempt and being removed one by one, we realize now, as we see our society imploding, what has been holding us together all this time has been that Christian male influence. Now that we have undermined all that with this whole sexuality issue and this gender issue and political posturing issue and all kinds of weak-minded, morally spineless men who are backing away from their God-given responsibilities, now we're all standing there watching our society just sink into the mire. And we're thinking, wonder why I didn't do that before. It's because those men didn't do all those things before. Now that we've done it, who's going to stop it? Who's going to stand up and turn it around? That's exactly what God asks in Ezekiel 22, verse 30. I looked for a man to stand in the gap, and I saw none. And we saw what happened with that, what happened to Judah when no one stood in the gap. Men of the world create gaps, and they widen gaps. That's what men of the world are really good at doing, is creating gaps, widening gaps. Men of God are ones who stand in the gaps, in order to breach really fix the breach between man and God, to stand in the gap, to recognize his responsibility. I said earlier that the family is the building block of society, and if the home leadership is dysfunctional, the society will follow. It will follow that dysfunctionality. And that's exactly what we're seeing today. So the family is broken down, and then, not surprisingly, the society is breaking down. We want to look at what this failed leadership in the home look like. I want to be specific on this because I don't want us just to look at this conceptually here. These are typical scenarios in a worldly home, sometimes, sadly, even in Christian homes. First of all, we have men who are failing to accept their roles as men, failing to accept their roles as husbands, failing to accept their roles as fathers. A family is like a ship without a captain in this case. The wife and children are forced to lead because the man will not. He has little concern for the family. His attention is put elsewhere. We're not saying he's completely irresponsible. What we're saying is that he is careless in the things that matter the most, in his God-given responsibilities and duties. Many husbands and fathers think that they are leading, but the evidence may not support that because they have a very skewed or incorrect understanding of what it even means to be a man of God. They have a skewed understanding of their role as a man of God in the household. Positions like husband and father need to be defined then objectively by God, not subjectively, like I think, I feel, I believe. Okay? So if you come up to me and say, well, I think I'm a man of God, or I believe that I'm a good, solid man of God, or I believe feel like I am a good father, with all due respect, I would probably just stop you right there and say, it really doesn't matter what you think, what you feel, what you believe. What matters is, what is factual? What does the evidence say? What does God say? That's what matters here. Not your subjective take on yourself or myself, but rather on what God says. Some men are crisis-driven. They have no stability. They have no foundation. They have no core values, and therefore the family has no foundation, stability, or core values. And in those cases, they just bounce from one crisis to the next, always bemoaning the latest problem, but usually this problem is the result of their own poor decisions, bad company, irresponsible behavior, all because the man is leading as the example, sadly. And I have seen this in my 30-plus years as a Christian. I have seen many men and families just bouncing from one crisis to the next, you know, just bouncing around. Now this is happening. Oh, now this is happening. You think, oh, they must have a dark cloud over their head. It must be a lot of bad things happen to them and them only. No, it's because of their own lack of responsibility that those things happen. They gravitate to problems. And they don't want to admit that. Then we have the man who is a compromiser. His life is a bunch of concessions and appeasements. He gives in against his better judgment. He has convictions, but he erodes those convictions with compromises because he's seeking peace at any price. And I tell you, his wife, his family, his friends, they know this and they take advantage of that. So here's a man who's constantly being taken advantage of. Or he allows his wife to usurp his leadership because he's chosen to marry a dominating woman, or because she became one because of his own lack of leadership. And so in this case, she makes plans without his consent. The children turn to her for decisions, not the man. You've seen this in families, I am sure of it, where it's the mom who makes all the major decisions. Dad's just kind of a puppet, right? He's kind of a mere figurehead, a token force. She's the one who controls the household. She controls the spending, and quite literally, she controls her husband. And that's because the man has allowed all that to happen. Or the man just can't make his word stick here. He makes decision, but a wife and children, they do as they please without consequence. The husband says yes, the wife says, oh no. And the husband says, or the father rather, to his children, he says no. And the children go, yeah, I'm going to do it anyway. And he's like, yeah, but, and they know he's not going to do anything. He has no power. He has no force. Can't make anything stick. The family doesn't respect him, and usually that lack of respect begins with the man himself. He doesn't respect himself, and so that translates then to lack of respect from others. Or there's a lack of what some have called velvet, the compassion. Here's a man who rules with an iron fist without compassion or consideration for his family. He makes decisions for his own benefit because, well, he be the man, right? And so he wants to be the one that benefits from every decision that is made. He doesn't consult his wife. He doesn't look to his children's needs. His wife is not a companion. She's a servant. His children don't fear him as in respect him. They fear his fist. Or they fear his intimidation. They fear him physically. Or we have the man with the oversized ego here. Here he has a feeling of superiority and smugness over his whole family. He really believes that he is more intelligent, more gifted, more capable, more qualified as a human being than the rest of his family. And he, therefore, has more worth than the rest of the family. No humility, lots of arrogance. He feels that he deserves more time, more attention, more praise for himself than does any of the rest of the family. And the family does not respect him, but they feel anger and contempt. These are some of the attributes, some of the characteristics of what failed leadership looks like. It's not pretty. I don't like being the one to get up here and talk about this. But this is what we're facing in the world. And sadly, sometimes we're facing this in the churches. Sometimes we're facing this in what are called Christian households. The causes of failure, this is not about birth defects and permanent situations. This is not about, well, that's just the way I am, and it'll never change. It's not about that. These are chosen decisions. These are chosen courses that people take. Whether you're a Christian or not, the same things can happen here. First of all, a lack of knowledge and wisdom. Not because a man is incapable of learning. He just doesn't learn. He refuses. He neglects learning, or he's apathetic to learning. I tell you, indifference and apathy are two of the biggest blights against our churches today. Indifference, which means, we can go either way, I don't really care. And apathy, which means I don't care about the whole thing. And that's really sad to see that, but that's becoming more and more common in across the brotherhood. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge." Not the end of it, but the beginning of it. "Fools despise wisdom and instruction," and yes, so do some men. They despise that. You can't teach a man who thinks he already knows everything. I've learned that very well over the years. You cannot teach a man anything who thinks he already knows everything. He is unteachable in that present course of mind. Matthew 7, verse 24, Jesus says, "Everyone who hears these words of mine and acts upon them will become a wise man who builds his house on the rock." Well, that takes time to do that, and you have to make time to do that. It takes effort. You have to make effort, okay? It takes commitment, and you got to make commitment to do that. Not all men are willing to do that. Hosea 4, 6, "My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. And so are many potential men of God." I want to read actually the whole verse there because most people just quote that part. It says in Hosea 4, verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, God says, I will also reject you from being my priest. Since you have forgotten the law of your God, I will also forget your children. That's pretty sobering, isn't it? God's saying, it's not just, oh, my people are destroyed. What are you going to do, right? Since this is so, then this is going to have a very negative consequence on your well-being, upon your children, upon your nation. I want you to think about that in terms of what's going on today. If we are being destroyed, we as a church are being destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Think about the reverberating effects, the consequences that are going to spill into our marriages, our families, and our society. We are going to reap what we sow. And then there's lack of conviction. Just like seeds thrown on the rocky soil that Jesus talks about there in Matthew 13, in the parable of the sower. They spring up, but they have no root, no stability. One can believe, one can understand, one can be convinced, but it does not mean that he is convicted. Because conviction, as you see on the screen, is a belief that is so strong, it demands action, not just church going. Demands action. And a man of God must have conviction. That's what we see in Jesus, in Stephen, Paul, Apollos, James, all the leaders in the New Testament. We are seeing men of conviction. Men who live for their families, men who live for their wives, but most of all, most importantly, men who live for Jesus Christ. That's what we need, men who live for Jesus. Because if you put Christ first in your life, then everything else will fall into place where it needs to be. Everything else, everyone else will be where it needs to be. Everything and everyone will find its rightful place because you've got Jesus in the right place, right? And then thirdly, cause of failure, lack of personal responsibility. Here's a man who knows what's right, but he's neither persistent nor consistent in that and often just does not care. Or he makes a decision, I will do this. And then that quickly evaporates over the course of the next few days or weeks. Or he forgets about it, or he changes his mind, or he's just deterred by something else. He says, I'm my own man, but then when that fails, he blames others, usually his wife, his children, his congregation, his preacher, his elders. Someone else is always to blame for his lack of being a responsible man. So we need to accept our own responsibility. That's part of being a man of God and part of being a leader is accepting your own responsibility. It's very straightforward, very clear cut, honestly. This is not rocket science. If it was, I couldn't teach it. I don't know anything about rocket science, okay? But I do know what the Bible teaches about being a man. And I do know that we, all men, can learn this. So remember I told you that this is going to be a little bit dark and negative and we have to face this. But today's churches, just like our society, are suffering from the lack of men of God. And the key word there is suffering. We are suffering from this. And we will continue to suffer more and more if something is not done. I'm not saying we're all doing it wrong. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we could all do better, for one. And there are some of us who are in need of perhaps more than just an admonition. Maybe an overhaul is in order. There's a critical need for godly men and godly leaders. The success of the family, congregation, society is directly affected by morality and leadership. Look into the example of Israel. That's all you need to do is read the Old Testament. You will see when morality tanked, when leadership tanked, the nation tanked. It all goes together. And I do want to commend those men here who are striving sincerely to be a man of God, someone that God is proud of, someone who sanctifies Jesus as Lord in their heart. If that is you, then I commend you. You're doing the right thing. My only admonition to you is to keep on doing that and do not be deterred by all the negative things that society and others will tell you. But I want to clarify something here when I say that. Just because you're a leader at work or a manager of money or spend time with your family or show up for services, that by itself does not make you a man of God. There's more to it than that. Those things are good. There's more to it than that, and we'll get into that as we go along. So men of God do not just pray, they are prayerful. They do not just study, they internalize the message, the gospel. They don't just come to church, but they seek and nurture fellowship with brothers and sisters in Christ. They don't just give to God, they're given over to God. They're given over to Him. They surrender to Him. The man of the world, yeah, he thinks he's his own man, but really he's a slave to other people's expectations. The faithful and obedient Christian man is truly a man of God. And that's where I want to bring it back to. What do you say about yourself, men? What do you say? Are you a man of God? What would your wife say if I were to ask her? What would your children say if I were to interview them? What do you think I would say if we could sit down and talk candidly? More importantly, what would Christ say if he would talk to you right now? What would he say about you? Are you a man of God? Perhaps you've made some bad choices in the past. It's time to make good ones. And men of God are those who always make good decisions, wise decisions, because they put God first in their life. So much more we could say. I hope that this has been helpful. We're going to go into better things next week as we start talking about the solutions. Now that we've addressed the problem and identified it, we want to start looking at solutions to this, solutions that any man can put into place here. If you need to come forward this morning and be baptized into Christ, or if you're ready to make a new commitment to God and want that commitment to be made public, then this would be your time to come forward if you need, as we stand and sing the song Richard's selected for us.